From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the White House applauds the ongoing 72-hour truce in Gaza amid hopes the pause in fighting will open the way to a prolonged end to the bloodshed.
The United States certainly supports the latest 72-hour ceasefire proposal that appears both sides are of respecting and abiding by at this point.
Also today, the billionaire Formula One boss who's paying his way out of a German bribery trial, and a second American patient infected by the Ebola virus in Liberia returns to the US for treatment.
Nancy is still very weak. She shows signs of continued improvement. She's showing signs of progress and is moving in the right direction.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The White House is applauding the ceasefire that's currently in place in Gaza between Israel and Palestinian groups. The 72-hour ceasefire, which began on Tuesday at 8 a.m. local time, appears to be holding up. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said Israel has made significant progress in destroying Hamas tunnels, along with sites used to launch rockets into Israel. Mr. Earnest also said the U.S. hopes this short-term ceasefire will lead to a longer agreement and a more permanent peace.
For weeks, the United States, from the President to the Secretary of State on down, has been actively engaged with the Israeli and Palestinian leadership to try to bring the violence to an end. The United States certainly supports the latest 72-hour ceasefire proposal that appears both sides are respecting and abiding by at this point.
The Pentagon has confirmed a U.S. general has been killed in an attack in Afghanistan. He is said to have been the highest-ranking American to be killed since the September 11th attacks in 2001. The U.S. Defense Department identified the attacker, who was in uniform, as an Afghan soldier who opened fire at a military training base near Kabul. More than a dozen others were injured in the attack, mostly Americans. U.S. Pentagon spokesperson James Kirby described attacks in Afghanistan as a pernicious threat.
As I said, right now, and the investigation is just now getting started, we believe that the assailant was an Afghan soldier. But I mean, and the reason I'm caveating it by saying we believe, because again, this investigation just got started, the incident just occurred. But I've seen no indications, we have no indications that he wasn't anything other than a member of the Afghan National Security Forces.
A second American aid worker infected with Ebola in West Africa has arrived in the U.S. A plane believed to be carrying missionary Nancy Reitbull has landed in the state of Georgia. She'll be treated at the same hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, as her colleague Dr. Kent Brantley, who was brought back to the U.S. on Saturday. U.S. correspondent Kate Fisher has more.
Emory Hospital in Atlanta is one of just four in the U.S. which is equipped to deal with cases of Ebola. Both patients are being treated in an isolation unit, and they've been given a new drug which has never before been tested on humans. They became infected with the deadly virus while working with patients at a hospital in Liberia. Border agents at airports in Washington and New York are on watch as delegations from some 50 African countries arrive in the nation's capital for an economic summit. But U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice has said the risk of Ebola transmission in the U.S. is very low. Kate Fisher, Washington.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A German court has agreed to drop bribery charges against Formula One magnate Bernie Ecclestone after he offered to pay $100 million. However, settling a bribery case with a cash payment has raised some eyebrows. Iris Spitzer reports from Berlin.
The 83-year-old British billionaire was charged with bribing a German banker 8 years ago in a transaction linked to selling a large stake in the motorsport business. Ecclestone has been on trial in Munich since March. German criminal law permits discretionary judgment for a fine or community service if the gravity of the wrongdoing warrants it. However, $100 million is the highest amount ever paid out in this manner, and raises the issue of whether Ecclestone simply bought his way out of the case. Ecclestone had faced up to 10 years in jail and would have had to give up control of Formula One, which he has built up for over 40 years. Ira Spitzer, Berlin.
And China is investigating a Canadian couple for suspected theft of military and intelligence information and for threatening national security. The official Xinhua news agency has identified the couple as Kevin and Julia Don Garrett, originally from Vancouver. Rachel Silverman has the details.
The Garretts are Canadian citizens who have been living in China off and on for 30 years. They own a coffee shop in Dandong, a Chinese city on the North Korean border. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says they're being investigated on suspicion of espionage. The ministry has not said whether the Garretts have been detained, but family members say they've been unable to reach the couple. The announcement of this investigation comes just 1 week after the Canadian government publicly accused China of hacking Canada's top scientific research agency. China has denied those accusations. Rachel Silverman, San Francisco.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. After weeks of bloody conflict in Gaza, a 72-hour truce agreed by both the Israelis and Palestinians appears to be standing firm. Before the ceasefire came into play, the Israeli military said ground forces had completed their mission of destroying a network of Hamas tunnels. Over 1,800 Palestinians and dozens of Israeli soldiers have died since fighting began on July 8th. LBC Radio's Lisa Aziz discussed the situation with Camilla Schick, a British journalist based in Tel Aviv.
At the moment, everybody's still holding their breath, but yet both sides have held fire, even though we saw a few rockets and airstrikes being exchanged literally into the last few minutes just before the ceasefire, 8 a.m. local time. And yes, the hope for an extension beyond 72 hours of this ceasefire, again, is what is being expressed by the parties involved, and that the hope is the Israeli delegation will travel to Cairo in the next few days to discuss a longer-term truce. For both sides.
Camilla, meanwhile, hopefully you heard what our reporter here said about the alleged death of a British aid worker. Are you able to bring us any more on that?
I wish I could. I did check in with a couple of British diplomats based in Israel yesterday, and as far as I don't actually know anything more about it than you do. It is true that they are looking into it. There is a possibility that this person who has allegedly been killed and who was an aid worker, yes, may have been a British citizen. And it could be that he was involved in aid or maybe possibly activism or some sort in Gaza. It's quite common for aid workers to travel during a time of war from Britain and elsewhere into Gaza. But I prefer not to speculate at this stage. At the moment, we really don't know anything further as of yesterday evening about who this was and what he was doing.
All right, Camilla. For ordinary Israelis there now then, having seen the death toll rise so high on both sides, are they still supporting, do you get a sense, even more attacks on Gaza and Hamas? Or is there a feeling now enough is enough?
Well, if we're talking about the Israeli public, they will, as a majority, stand behind what their leaders think is best for defense. And the IDF has said that they are pulling back their troops and they have completed their mission of destroying the cross-border tunnels. But they have also strongly warned that if any more fire, any more retaliation comes from within Gaza, that they will respond strongly. And Israelis will not question that. I mean, they have stood behind their leaders as a majority for most of this war, and if they're attacked again, they will also stand behind any response that the IDF will give.
Camilla Schick, journalist based in Tel Aviv. And the Gaza conflict was also tackled by London's mayor, Boris Johnson, who was live on LBC Radio when he learned that Britain's most high-profile Muslim politician, Sayeeda Warsi, had resigned over her government's position on the violence.
Well, I would say it's very sad when any government minister resigns, and I've got a great respect for Sayeeda. I think she's done a great job for us, and I hope she'll be back as soon as possible.
Can you support the government policy on Gaza?
Well, look, my view as mayor of London, as I've said ever since I was elected, and we've been around this track many, many times, is that it's not the function of the mayor to get deeply embroiled in something
must have a view.
That's something that divides London so bitterly. If you want my view, yes, I do think that what is happening in Gaza is utterly horrifying and unacceptable. And everybody, and on that point, there is no difference between politicians. I think that there's no point in us all politicians getting into a kind of bidding war about who can issue the most, frenzied denunciations of what is going on. It is obviously horrifying, and I want it to stop, and I, pray it stops. I cannot for the life of me see what how this can be a sensible strategy. On the other hand, the people will put countervailing arguments about the difficulties of a population facing rocket fire and all the rest of it, but it is not my function as mayor to try and arbitrate or adjudicate in this matter.
But you have a lot of people of Israeli descent living in this town,
I have a lot of sympathy with people in Gaza who are in absolute terror of their lives. Of course I do.
So the way Israel is behaving is...
Look,
disproportionate?
I would certainly say it was disproportionate. I would not. I certainly believe it's disproportionate. I mean, I'm a passionate Zionist. I'm a supporter of Israel. I've been on a kibbutz, for heaven's sake.
You're a Zionist?
I believe in the existence of the State of Israel. I believe in the existence of the State of Israel. But
for Palestine?
And I believe in a two-state solution. I cannot for the life of me see how this helps us get there. I think that it is disproportionate. I think it is ugly and it is tragic. And I don't think it will do Israel any good in the long run. But in having that opinion, I'm merely echoing what everybody else is, I think, saying at the moment. What these guys need to do is have a ceasefire on both sides.
Well, it seems to be holding
and sort it out. But it has been absolutely devastating to watch it. London is a city that brings together communities across the world, and we must not, if we can possibly avoid it, import onto our streets the tensions and the divisions that you see around the world. And that's been my approach as mayor. I've wanted to bring people together. I have Muslim antecedents and I have Jewish antecedents and all the rest of it. That should be totally irrelevant. This is a city that is about certain values that we defend and we uphold. And yes, I would like to see those values upheld around the world, but we're not going to sort it out. I'm not going to sort this problem out from City Hall, and it would be pretentious to try to do so.
So what you're saying is if Israelis and Palestinians got on better, we'd have a legion of Boris Johnsons.
Well, it's not for me to map out the future for that part of the world. But yes, I mean, if you want I would like to see, that was the original vision, by the way. The original vision, when you go back to 1917 and you look at what the Balfour Declaration was all about, you look at what they hoped to achieve. They hoped to achieve a homeland, what the government incoherence in 19... They hoped to achieve a homeland for the Jewish people, but they also hoped that there would be a huge benefit for the indigenous population as well.
London Mayor Boris Johnson with LBC's Nick Ferrari. This is FSN Reports. $100 million, the staggering amount Formula One boss Bernie Ecclestone will cough up to put an end to his bribery trial in Germany. The 83-year-old billionaire was first in court in Munich earlier this year over allegations that he bribed a former German banker as part of the sale of a major stake in his F1 racing empire. $99 million is expected to go to the German Treasury and $1 million to a German children's charity. Ira Spitzer is our Germany correspondent.
Mr. Ecclestone was on trial for bribery. He's alleged to have given German banker Gerhard Gribkowski $44 million. This happened about 8 years ago, and that happened in a transaction related to selling a large share of Formula One to a company called CVC Ventures. Now, the allegation was that he had essentially bribed the German banker in order to stay at the helm of Formula One. Gribkowski, for his part, is serving 8.5 years in jail for taking that bribe. Now, what Mr. Ecclestone said, that he doesn't deny paying the money, but he said he was actually being blackmailed by Mr. Grybkowski related to some tax dealings in England. The way that this case ended is neither an admission of guilt or innocence by anybody involved. So basically, he is now a free man. We don't know exactly what happened, but the prosecutors, the judge, the people involved apparently felt that they're either the case wasn't strong enough, or given Mr. Ecclestone's advanced age, that it simply was not worth pursuing the case, given Mr. Ecclestone's offer of $100 million to settle the case.
So is this as straightforward as $100 million buying his freedom? And if so, how has this decision gone down in Germany?
Well, this decision has made major waves both within Germany and outside of the country's borders for the seemingly ridiculous nature of it, in that an individual can be charged or tried for bribery and then pay to drop the case. And the prosecutors and the judge apparently thought that was a good idea, and they did drop the case. So that's, looking that that somewhat simplified view of things has made some people pretty upset. We've had some comments in Germany saying it's an embarrassment for the justice system, that obviously this favors wealthy individuals, and so on. As I understand it, the purpose of the law, it's perhaps a little more nuanced, but the purpose is to prevent sort of long and drawn out trials, or where it's not really considered a good use of the time of all the parties involved in a situation where the guilt will not be eager to prove. We don't know all the details into how this decision was reached. However, that being said, I'd say the overwhelming reaction on social media, in the press, is one of a bit of astonishment that that this trial could end this way.
But Ira, how troubling will this fine be for Mr. Ecclestone? Because he's not short of a dollar or two, is he?
Well, $100 million for Bernie Ecclestone is almost nothing. I mean, this is a man who was commuting to the trial, which he had to attend about 2 days a week from his yacht in the Mediterranean, as well as his house in Switzerland. He's worth about $4.2 billion. So if you do the math on that, $100 million is definitely something that he can afford to pay, which is, you know, something that bothers a lot of people about this settlement. Now, looking at Mr. Ecclestone's career overall, it's a pretty amazing run. It sounds like he's going to go back to running Formula One now, which is the business that he essentially built up from nothing. A scenario that did seem sort of implausible. He had this criminal case in Germany. He also had civil cases going on in the United States and Great Britain. He had tax issues in Britain. But somehow he's managed to make all these problems disappear, in this case simply by perhaps by reaching into his pocket. So we'll see. We'll see what the next chapter is for Bernie Ecclestone and Formula One.
Ira Spitzer in Berlin. And finally tonight, as a second American aid worker infected with the Ebola virus is flown from Liberia back to the United States, today's FSN Spotlight focuses on the outbreak and what can be done to stop its devastating spread. Here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, another look at the growing global concern over Ebola. The United Nations said on Monday that in 2 days alone last week, 61 people died of the disease in West Africa. A total of at least 887 people have now succumbed to the virus, which has been focused so far on the nations of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, and has, some experts believe, a fatality rate of 70%. There are growing worries that it could be impossible to quarantine the virus to just three countries. Gideon Ruckman of the Financial Times has been discussing the crisis with the newspaper's science editor Clive Cookson and its Africa editor Javier Bliss. And Javier Bliss starts the conversation by providing the background to the recent spread of the virus.
The outbreak started in early February in a very remote and forest area of Guinea, and since then has spread to another two countries in West Africa, Sierra Leone and Liberia. The biggest concern is that so far the outbreak doesn't seem to slow down, and obviously because the borders are very porous in the region, there is a great concern that the disease may spread to other areas of West Africa, and particularly economic heavyweights, including Nigeria.
Now, Clive, as I mentioned, the British cabinet's even meeting and discussing this. Is that an overreaction, or are we really facing the risk of a global pandemic that could arrive in Europe and so on?
I don't think we're facing the threat of a global pandemic, no. If, as Javier says, this got into the mega city of Lagos with 20 million or so people, it could be a devastating regional epidemic, and Britain should be concerned. The rest of the world should be concerned for that reason. But the nature of the Ebola virus that causes the disease means that if it got here, say, if someone suffering from the disease flew into Heathrow and wasn't caught, there could be some horrible sporadic cases in the UK, but the Western health infrastructure is good enough to stop it. It's not like flu, which can be spread through the air and tiny droplets. With Ebola, the virus is only spread by immediate contact with patients or their body fluid. So with good barrier medical and nursing care, you should be able to stop it. The trouble is that care is not available in a lot of West Africa.
So for Africa, at least, is this a rational concern, or are people particularly scared by Ebola, partly because it seems like such a horrible disease in the symptoms, the way that people lose their mind and the bleeding and all of that?
Oh, it is a horrific disease. And the 50 to 60% lethality rate is, of course, horrifying. But I think in the context of Africa, and also the cultural and social context, because as well as a poor health infrastructure, there's a widespread fear in Africa of traditional Western medicine. People look on Western health centres as a place to go and die, and they even accuse doctors and nurses of spreading the disease. That's why it's going to be hard to stop.
Javier, is that something that you're hearing reported, that it's getting very, very hard, even when you can mobilise medicine to get in there, to actually persuade people to take part?
Yes, let me give you an example. It was the first case that was reported in Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone. And this is also very important to bear in mind. In the past outbreaks of Ebola, the virus was restricted on very remote areas in Central Africa, particularly in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda and Sudan. And it was villages. This time the virus is affecting urban population and even the capitals of some countries. So that's a big change from a previous outbreak in the previous decade at today. But in the case that I was mentioning, a woman suffered the disease. She was conducted to the hospital in Freetown, and her relatives kidnapped her from the hospital and drove her into a local healer where she died. So that's the distrust on Western medicine, in part because the local population is beginning to realize that those who go to hospital, they only leave as dead because the disease have this horrific mortality rate of 60%. So that's one problem. It's also a problem of cultural funerals. The way that the bodies are washed by hand immediately after the death, it means that that's exactly the moment where the body is more contagious, and the physical contact with the fluids makes that relatives are getting sick very quickly. Indeed, the moment the main source of new cases are doctors, nurses and relatives of the sick.
So, Clive, it sounds like a horrifying situation, but Ebola is not a new disease. When did we first discover it, and why is it getting such a serious outbreak now?
It was first discovered in 1976. It's probably been in the remote parts of Africa for decades, centuries, millennia, who knows? It has a wild animal reservoir, and that's thought to be fruit bats. It may have got into people through eating fruit bats, because they're apparently a delicious form of bushmeat. The reason it's spreading now is increased mobility, I think. Unfortunately, from the point of view of diseases, there's more and more mobility within Africa as there is everywhere in the world. But this is not being accompanied by a corresponding increase in Western health infrastructure.
So, Javier, we talked about, perhaps lopsidedly initially, about the reaction here in Britain and in Europe. But given the situation, the fact that it's not under control, what's the reaction in Africa itself? Do you see a step change in the government's reaction there?
We have had a significant step change in the government's reaction over the last week, 10 days, particularly the three countries where they have been suffering from the very beginning, the outbreak, Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea, they're beginning to change. In particular, Liberia is imposing border restrictions, is monitoring everyone who is crossing the borders. Regional airlines have suspended flights to the three countries involved. So we are beginning to see also a reaction from business leaders. And particularly, if you look also the reaction in Nigeria. The three countries where the disease started, they were a bit slow to react. Also, they're among the poorest in the West Africa region. But if you look at the reaction of the Nigerian authorities when they got a case, a single case of a Liberian man who landed in Lagos airport feeling sick, he was immediately transported to hospital. He died a few hours later. That hospital has been shut down, quarantined. All the doctors have been put in quarantine. So it's a very decisive reaction by the authorities in Nigeria to stop, as Clive was saying, the best way to combat the disease is with prevention, with quarantine and with barriers. And that's exactly what the authorities of Nigeria have done. And that's beginning to be what the authorities in their three countries are beginning to do.
So, Clive, it sounds like quite an impressive reaction by the Nigerians. Do you think it's likely to be enough?
I think it might be enough. I'm a bit Pollyanna-ish, but I myself don't think this is going to develop into a regional apocalypse. I think it can be stopped. And I think that for all its faults, Nigeria probably, at least in Lagos, has a better medical infrastructure than the other countries that Javier has been talking about.
And also, it's not only the infrastructure, it's the political decision-making and the doctors' decision-making. You see a very, very quick reaction. It was not hesitation. It was not even a minute lost. The man arrives to the airport. He feels sick. Immediately is quarantined. When he dies and is confirmed is Ebola, the hospital is shut down. It's quarantined. Everything is going to be clean. So I think that the authorities now, particularly in Nigeria, are taking this very, very seriously, and they will be able to stop it.
That is quite impressive, and perhaps for people who don't travel regularly to Nigeria, counterintuitive, because this is a country where most of the headlines recently have been bad, above all about Boko Haram, which gives a sense of a country that doesn't have a central government that's still really in control of the place. And of course, the continuing stories about ramshackle infrastructure in Lagos and so on. But the reaction to Ebola suggests that's only half the story.
No, exactly. And, you know, the country, particularly Lagos, is the most developed area of Nigeria. The airport is a very good airport for African standards. And you are monitored by fever. They have some infrared monitors where each of the passengers, when you are approaching the immigration control, they check on your face and they check what is your temperature. So you are showing that you arrive from the UK with the flu and you are a bit of a fever. Someone is going to stop you and say, what's the problem, where you are coming from? And they're going to check whether you are trying to get into the country with a disease. So I think that they're getting it. Also, the international response, we have seen £2 million from the UK government for the World Health Organization and Medicine Sans Frontiers. Today, Wednesday, the European Union has announced another €2 million of additional aid. So the headlines are also triggering a much bigger contribution by the international community, and more charities are beginning to try to step up their work in the region.
I think what they most need is good diagnostics, because although there's no drug that can affect this, the only thing you can do for patients is to make sure they're properly hydrated. There are good quick diagnostic tests for this virus, but they need to be done in high security facilities. And if we're talking about Western aid for this particular outbreak, I think diagnosis plus really good, reliable barrier equipment, all those protective suits and goggles and gloves and so on, that's what are needed.
That's Clive Cookson, science editor of the Financial Times, ending that conversation about Ebola. He was talking with Javier Bliss, the paper's Africa editor, and the conversation was hosted by the FT's Gideon Ruckman. You can follow all the paper's international reporting in its famous pink pages every day and online at ft.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to tell us what you think of the programme, email us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there @FeatureStory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.